Chris Botti is here. The Grammy Award-winning trumpet player is beloved for his unmistakable tone as a player that has taken him from pop to jazz to classical and back again. Here at the New Classical FM, you've heard Chris play everything from George Gershwin and Ennio Morricone to his take on Andrea Bocelli's Time to Say Goodbye and Puccini's Nessun Dorma. Chris Botti was raised in Oregon, where he went eventually to the University of Indiana and played Carnegie Hall before he was 20 years old. His early gigs were with names you know, Buddy Rich, Frank Sinatra, and by the 1990s, Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, Aretha Franklin, and Bette Midler. In 1995, he began his recording career with Verve Records, then Columbia. He collaborated with Sting, starting a long-standing musical relationship. He was heard on numerous scores and soundtracks, recording a holiday album and several jazz-focused releases. In 2007, he paired up with Andrea Bocelli on his Italia recording, noting the years he had spent in Italy while he was growing up. His public television specials paired him up with Yo-Yo Ma, Josh Groban, Caroline Campbell, and the Boston Pops. He's also worked closely with Canadian pianist and producer David Foster. We should also note that in 2004, he was named one of People magazine's most beautiful people. Chris Botti will take the Massey Hall stage in Toronto on Wednesday, March 12th. The performance will note his debut with Blue Note Records, released in 2023, titled Volume 1. The album is a refocusing on jazz repertoire, including his early love of Miles Davis. Chris Botti, we're so excited to have you on the program. Welcome.
Thank you for that This Is Your Life introduction. That's very nice.
I know in Toronto, we're excited to hear your signature tone in that space, Massey Hall. It is just so beautiful, the acoustic. You've been there many times, but I think this is your first time with the new renovation.
Yeah, I get asked a lot doing interviews throughout the world, you know, what's your favorite place to play? And I think unmistakably, the sound in Massey Hall has always been one of the most rewarding feedback that you get on that stage. And I am so looking forward. I mean, we were speaking before the interview started. We've been to Toronto many times since they've closed the place to renovate. And every time we roll in, I'm always to my manager, when are they going to do Massey Hall? When is it finished? So when I heard that this booking came up and we will be there, it is going to be the highlight of the year, I know, for me personally, because it's just a really special place. And I can't wait to see the workings of, you know, how it looks and all that stuff. It's going to be an exciting night for me personally to stand on that stage.
I think you're going to be really delighted. They've done a beautiful job, but also keeping the history of it. You know, you're a person who can do it all. This jazz record that you're touring, but then classical repertoire on so many recordings. Talk about that idea of not picking a lane as a player and being able to play genre to genre to genre over your whole career.
Well, I mean, in defense of classical trumpet players, I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, it's kind of faux classical. I'm taking a lyrical approach to playing classical-ish music, but those lanes opened up through friendship. I mean, like David Foster is the guy that I wrote the song Italia with, and he convinced Andrea Bocelli to sing it. And through my friendship with David, he sort of opened that door for me to consider doing a duet with Andrea. And from that, you know, when you're standing in that space and making music with him, and you go, oh, this actually sounds really good, and it feels very natural. If I just play myself on top of this classical backdrop and not try to necessarily go in and say, I'm going to play it like someone playing the Hummel or a Haydn trumpet concerto, that's not what I want to do. And all the people that I've worked with, for the most part, long periods of time, Sting or Paul Simon or Streisand or whatever, we have a personal connection, and then that leads to making music. And that makes it so much easier in a way and less anxiety-ridden when you're trying to like cross genres like that. It's a much more comforting feeling.
I think people hear those names, whether it be a Bette Midler or a Streisand or a Sting or a Paul Simon, and they say, okay, you found a personal connection there, and then the music was sort of built on top of that. But that seems like such a hill to climb to sort of, you know, get in that sphere of those people and speak the same musical language. I mean, where do those connections come from? How are you finding those people?
I've always said this. How do you navigate all these different artists? And you can't. It's like the yellow brick road, you know, you're standing there looking and you're going to go find Oz, but you can't really figure it out. You got to just deal with one step at a time. I remember when I was in Sting's band, we did a charity event, and I played a solo, and David Foster came over and introduced himself, and we became friends from that. That was 2001. And then we just sort of kept in touch, and things just kind of evolved from there. And then, you know, he would introduce me to Streisand, and then I remember playing at a Clinton Global Initiative thing years ago, and the president came on stage and said how much he liked my music, and Streisand was in the audience, and she came up to me and said, we should do something. It's just these random kind of things that just spark.
Yeah,
you have no real control over it. All you really have to do is, fingers crossed, and go to the next brick on the road and hope that it's going to be a profitable musical experience for you.
But, obviously they're responding to what they're hearing, and we get calls and emails all the time. People always talk about your tone as a trumpet player. There's this sort of clear, shimmering sound that you produce that is so appealing to people, and certainly all those big stars you talked about that you made those connections with. As a trumpet player who's been, you know, playing for a long time, you probably have wanted to experiment in all different realms, but how did you find that sound that is so signature to you?
I don't know the answer to that. I will say this, that I've seen jazz musicians work with singers, and they play jazz around the singers, and I try to play like a singer against the singer. Like, oddly enough, another Canadian, I did a tour with Joni Mitchell and her band in 1999, and she gave me some unbelievably great advice. Mm. She goes, you know, when I'm sitting there singing, don't knock me out of the batter's box. Make it so like I'm still there, and you just kind of like float around me. And I was like, ah,
yeah,
yes. To a lot of jazz musicians, because they're used to just playing their stuff and having the audience listen to them, they don't allow for the passage of another sound there. So, you know, you got to lean up against the singer and then back away.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's so great about Streisand, because she would manipulate almost like an instrumentalist. We'd be doing like What'll I Do or Funny Valentine or something like that on stage. And it was magic, like the way she would allow space for me too as well. As a jazz musician, you need to be a fan of those singers.
Yeah.
And a lot of jazz musicians, they don't really, that's not their cup of tea. They don't sit around and listen to them. They don't know the nuances of someone like that. They might know the nuances of someone like Tony Bennett, but the popular singers like Paul Simon or Sting or whatever, they don't necessarily gravitate towards that. But I'm a fan of that stuff. I'm a big sophisticated popular music, you know, someone like Sting or Paul or Joni or Streisand, you know. And so, yes, they're popular, but it's not just a bubblegum radio chart. It's a long career of just artistry and wonderful skill set.
You're reminding me of when I had Ethan Hawke in here, and he had played Chet Baker in that film.
And that's probably one of the best movies of an instrumentalist that's out there. Sorry to cut you off.
No, his quote was, his voice sounds a lot like his trumpet, or he kind of sounds as a singer as he does as a trumpet player. And I kind of like that. And I think it speaks a little bit to what you're talking about, is just being lyrical in that way and thinking of your horn a little bit like a singer sometimes. I mean, if I'm on the right track.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned that, because the trumpet, you tongue, ta, 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 you tongue the sound of the, and classical musicians tongue much more forward and like that. It's a, but if you listen to the way Chet Baker sings, he puts the tongue back in the roof of your mouth,
mm-hmm.
and it's ta ta. It's this soft thing, and when he sings, enunciates, it's in the same place as when he tongues, where he puts the tongue to attack a note on the trumpet. It's this softer, more. It's almost like diffused. It's just not so pointed and aggressive.
Yeah.
And that's the way he tongues when he plays the trumpet, too. That's what gives the similarity, because the articulation is bounced by the same thing. He's on point with that for sure, Ethan Hawke is.
I love the deconstruction there. That's wonderful. I'll also point out that I went to that Joni Mitchell tour. That was the first time I paid $100 for a ticket.
The one with Dylan
With Dylan, and with Van Morrison was there too. So
wow.
That was a heck of a night. That was in Vancouver. Good memory there. If you are just joining us, trumpeter Chris Bode, our guest on The Oasis here on the New Classical FM. My name is Mark Wigmore. Chris will play Massey Hall on Wednesday, March 12th. Tickets at MasseyHall.com or chrisbode.com. Latest album is Volume 1, which is out on Blue Note. So pretty exciting, Chris. I mean, I know it's been out for a couple of tours now, but tell us about this Blue Note project and what you wanted to do with it.
I guess first and foremost, it was spurred on by the fact that I got David Foster to produce it for me, and that was an awesome feeling. And I remember when I took him out to dinner, I was like, David, come on, man, do this. And he goes, man, I haven't produced a record. The last record I produced was Michael Bublé's, and it was 7 years ago. I haven't produced anything, but I'll come out of retirement to do your record. Let's do it. As long as we can do it in a week. And I said, no problem. It would be great. That was the thing that made me kind of super excited about doing a record in the first place. I mean, the whole world was kind of coming out from trying to like figure out our footing. That's why I called it Volume One in many ways. I mean, I just turned 60, but also we were coming out of the recalculation of COVID and all that stuff and how we relate to one another. And so I just wanted to like rewrite the truth and just start over.
Yeah.
And that's why I labeled it Volume One. And also in hoping that, you know, we could do Volume Two and Three. Again, it's just part of the journey and part of trying to document your life. I mean, I went a long time without making a record. My last record I made was 2013. And we've been touring. We're on the road 260 days a year or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I went from Columbia Records having an association with them for 15, 16 years, something, and then switching over to Blue Note. And by the time the lawyers all get involved and stuff like that, we were set to record in the end of 2019 into 2020. And then everything got halted and delayed. So by the time I actually released a record, it was like 9 years between records or 10 years, something like that.
It's interesting. You have a lot of Victoria people around you. David Foster. It sounds like your tour manager is from Victoria.
My manager and tour manager, yeah.
And I'm a Victoria guy, so there's something about Victoria in your life.
Well, there's a lot of great musicians from that part of Canada, you know, Vancouver and Victoria and, you know, Diana Krall, et cetera.
Yeah, that's true.
It's such an incredible musical place in the world. It's awesome. Bublé and Bryan Adams, and man.
I know. It's fun. It's fun to think
Where's Katie Lang from?
Katie Lang, I think, is a Prairies, Prairies gal, but what a voice. Unbelievable.
Yeah. I duetted with her and Tony Bennett on a video with Tony Bennett years ago. She's just an awesome singer.
She is so incredible.
And I played on one of her records, too, as well. She wasn't there when I played on the record, but she was there when I played on the video with Tony. That was great.
Yeah, well, Tony we had here a couple times before he left us, and what a guy he was, too.
I played for his Kennedy Center Honors Award. I'm not really into stuff. I don't really, you know, I'm not a guy that collects a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I know what you're going to say.
What?
Well, my guess is he made a little piece of artwork for you or something like that.
He did.
Yeah.
Like he did a drawing of George Gershwin, and he gave it to me, and I was just like, oh, my God. I mean, it arrived in the mail after I played the Kennedy Center Honors for him, and it's probably the thing I cherish most in my apartment in New York. It was just sitting there in the kitchen, and it's like, oh, I was very proud of that. That was a really beautiful gift.
I don't blame you. That is so incredible. You mentioned Joni Mitchell. We talked a little bit about your Andrea Bocelli connection. I mean, just a couple names that stick out, and certainly part of our world, Yo-Yo Ma. I mean, that must have been something.
Yeah. Originally, I played on his Christmas album. And the folks at Columbia Records hooked me up with him. And then when we were doing the Live in Boston album, I called him and said, would he want to do it? Obviously, he lives outside of Boston, and he was gracious enough to say yes. Unfortunately, I think that might have been the last time I saw him. We've spoken a couple times since then, but I haven't been in the same, you know, hemisphere or whatever around him. But what an unbelievable, not only an unbelievable sound and artist, but what a unique, charismatic icon he is. He's one of those guys, and he just walks into a room and you know, he's Yo-Yo Ma. What a legend.
And I mean, I guess I have to ask, and I know it was really early in your career, and he's been gone for a long time, but I just, when people have maybe been close to the chairman, Frank Sinatra, you have to kind of ask about that. I mean, what was that experience?
Well, I mean, I dropped out of college on a Wednesday, and my first gig with Sinatra was on a Thursday, and I dropped out of college in Indiana, and my first gig with Sinatra was in Hollywood, and this was 1984. When you get off an airplane from Indiana to Hollywood in 1984, rest assured, it looks a lot different in Hollywood in 1984 than it does in Bloomington, Indiana.
Sure does.
I remember checking into the hotel going, oh my God, what is going on? And it was pretty rough, pretty heavy, old Hollywood kind of that. But then, you know, that has nothing to do with Sinatra. Like, and then going to the show, my time with Sinatra was really a 2-week engagement at the Universal Amphitheater. And it was the comeback record he did called L.A.'s My Lady.
I remember.
Now, produced by Quincy and all this stuff. And it was a big time deal for Sinatra. And because it was, the audience was loaded with so many Angie Dickens and all the celebs were there, Rickles, he showed up to soundcheck. It was amazing because he would walk on stage every night, and I've never seen this from an artist since. He was a star, of course. He was a worldwide icon, and so he had all that certain something that everyone loves about a star. But then he would speak to people sometimes in the front row or the first few rows, a la somebody like Don Rickles. You know, he would have a conversation, whether it's music or just chatting with people down front. And then he would always turn around and acknowledge the drummer, the arranger, the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. If you think about it, pop musicians don't do that anymore. Barely even, like if you're a pop band, they barely even look at each other anymore. And everyone's wearing in-ear monitors, let alone relating to someone like a comic does. I mean, he had so many years of doing that stuff with, whether it was with Rickles or Sammy Davis or Dean Martin. And so, you know, he's got a lot of other weapons for a show than just performing his stuff.
Yeah.
But he was always so gracious to acknowledge the musicianship that went behind him. He always said, we're going to do this song, and it's a Don Costa arrangement. And that particular night, Nelson Riddle was conducting. So it was the Nelson Riddle Orchestra with Nelson Riddle, you know, like, so it was a really special thing. And so we did In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning, and I've, of course, covered that song many times since. But to have him sing that and have those legendary Burt Reynolds, you know, yeah, it was great.
That is a real show business story. It's pretty special for you to have. And
well, you know, the embarrassing part is that the sound check, when he came to the first day, he didn't come the other days, but the first day he showed up to the sound check. So I'd only been in the band for maybe an hour. And I stood up to take a solo on Fly Me to the Moon. And at the end of the thing, he, you know, like I said, he was always very gracious. He goes, nice solo, kid. And I was convinced that Frank and I were going to be, you know, taking some, you know, hot blondes down to Palm Springs or something. You know, I thought we were buddies.
Enjoying,
right?
So, an old fashioned. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And I went up to him and I said, Mr. Sinatra, I'm Chris Bode from Oregon. And he said, okay, nice to meet you. And he was fine, you know, whatever. But his assistant came over and said, don't bother Mr. Sinatra anymore. You know, I was a little overconfident after he gave me that compliment of nice solo kids.
Well, you still have the compliment, so that's that's pretty great. You know, you talk about 200 plus dates a year, and so I know the focus has to be on touring, and the record was an exciting thing to do within a 10-year spectrum. So what are you kind of looking forward to as we get into the next 2025 and the year after?
Well, we did something last year. I started hosting my own cruise.
Okay.
We fly to Miami and we take a cruise ship and do Chris Bode at Sea. This is our second year. To make it Canadian friendly, you know, it's David Foster, Catherine McPhee, Diana Krall, Kamasi Washington, Esperanza Spalding, Kool and the Gang. I mean, it's just so cool to have all these.
Those are some heavy hitters. My goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm so looking forward to doing it again. Last year was, they've asked me to host my own cruise for years, and I didn't think I would like it as much as I did. For the most part, the reason I liked it is because all the musicians respected each other. They got along. They weren't late. There was no diva fits. People were so great. I was like, I'm going to do it again. So we're signed up for this year, and we're signed up again for 2026. So 2026 leaves out of Los Angeles and goes up to Vancouver and Victoria.
Have you started selling that one yet?
Yeah, that's on sale.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll remind people of that because that sounds like a great cruise. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
We do a couple of cruises here at the New Classical FM, but they do not have Kamasi Washington on them. I can tell you that much.
Yeah. That's funny.
Chris, it's just been a joy to hear your stories and to talk a little bit about trumpet playing and your music. And thanks a lot for being here.
Well, I appreciate it. And I want to wish you all the very, very best for 2025 and well beyond.
Absolutely. A real pleasure. Chris is going to be playing Massey Hall on Wednesday, March 12th, his big return to the renovated space. Tickets at masseyhall.com and chrisbode.com. The latest album is Volume 1, which is out on Blue Note.